People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Go where you are watered. Today, we're going to hear a story of two very different experiences of grad school. We'll hear a first-hand account of the difference between an environment that supports and accommodates someone experiencing a mental health issue and one that puts additional hurdles in the way of someone already going through a challenging period. Alusha Ishagu shared some of her experiences in a first-person piece published on the website Mad in America. The Philadelphia-based social worker and doctoral candidate at Columbia University joined me to expand on those experiences.
My name is Alusha Ishagu. I am a behavioral health social worker, and I also work in health and behavior studies. That's currently what I'm studying right now through a doctoral program that I am in. I'm very passionate about mental health. It's something that I've been working in since about 2022 full-time, but the passion developed in 2016 in general, which is when I became symptomatic or I noticed that something was not fully correct. And I'm based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in the East Coast of the U.S.
And you recently shared a tale of two very different graduate school experiences. I'm wondering maybe what parts of that experience, those experiences, did you most want to communicate with people?
So I think what would be, is helpful is the whole idea of there is a space for you. Just because one environment might not seem hospitable, that doesn't mean that there isn't a space for you in the grander scheme of academics. I started my graduate education at one university. About 4 weeks into the program, I got hospitalized, ended up taking a year off. And next thing I knew, I found myself in a different graduate program as matriculating back into the other one was, I don't want to say impossible, but very, very, very difficult. So, yeah.
I'm wondering if you could get into some detail, maybe if you're willing to, as much as you're willing to share, on maybe what it was like realizing that there was something that you needed to go and seek help with while that was happening.
So if we're approaching it from the graduate school perspective, that school year, I'd had a friend tell me I needed to get hospitalized. I'd had a therapist tell me I should probably seek hospitalization. I was working with a new psychiatrist, and I just was like, I wasn't well. And the irony is my medication course would be considered much stronger then than it is now, but I was still very symptomatic because I wasn't addressing the bigger issue of my environment just not being that great. And, you know, I'm charging ahead. I've never had any type of break at that point. Since school, I finished even college in 3 years and some change, which in the US, we do it in 4 years, some people 4 years and some change. And I get to school and I'm noticing that everyone is nice. I'm not having any interpersonal issues. But for example, we had a summer reading and I could barely focus. We got the book I got it as a hard copy. My mind was like, I could not read past the first two pages. Then I get the e-version. I thought maybe that would be different. Same problem. Then I get the audiobook. And I'm just like, there's like a sense of denial that something is not right. And I started seeing a therapist at the university I was originally at. And eventually my suicide screen came up positive. So they took me to a hospital in our area and I was evaluated over there. I was able to kind of speak my way out of getting hospitalized. But then again, my friend took me home and I just felt like I was terrified the moment she said she was leaving. And I had actually called 911 to see if they could take me to the hospital. And the operator had told me it would be better if I took my own self there. So I was kind of taken aback. And I ended up taking an Uber to a crisis center. Again, the doctor and I talked. They're like, you seem pretty okay. Maybe it's just life stressors. I go back to the university as part of the plan was after that night that my screen had come up positive for a positive suicide screen, that I would come to the university the next day. And I think the woman, she kind of seemed in shock to see me that they hadn't hospitalized me. And she's like, oh, let's take you back. And she, I don't know what she said to the doctor who was there, but essentially I was told you have two choices. You can voluntarily go or you can get involuntarily hospitalized. So I said, you know what? I'm going to say yes. I'm going to go. Because involuntary, they can really, in general, they can keep you as long as they think is necessary. But involuntary, very much so, you could end up being there a lot longer than you might have anticipated. So that started the journey. I was there for about a week. I could tell they wanted to keep me longer as they couldn't figure out exactly what the issue was. And my diagnosis had been so off since I had started seeking treatment in 2016. And I got out and I was like, I feel like hell, like I could barely get out of bed. And unfortunately, I had two losses right after I came out from the hospital. My grandmother died and then my aunt died. I'm like a week apart. So at this point, I'm like, I can barely even walk down the street because it feels like it's taking all the energy inside of me to do anything. And I had another, you know, situation where I'm feeling suicidal again. And the school encouraged me, I would say slightly coercion, to take a leave of absence. And I was on leave for an entire school year. So it was, it took a long time to process that. I found it to be traumatic, to be honest. It was tough.
You told me, we were talking before, and you told me that that year off saved your life. Could you tell me a bit about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I said it was traumatic in the sense that I had moved to a completely different state to go to grad school. So the whole process of now I'm here in a different state, like, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to go back home? But finally, it was forced time that I got to actually just focus on myself. I was sleeping more than I usually had even allowed myself to do. And I was seeking treatment, although the focus of the treatment was, I need to get better so I can go back into school. That's my goal, just to get better. And after the hospitalization, I did a partial hospitalization program. I just got to be with other people who also had mental disorders, as I pretty much always kind of been taught to hide it. Like, not saying that you should be broadcasting your health concerns, but really, that's the one thing you don't want anyone to know about. Just keep it to yourself. And I was with other people who I can speak freely with. I was able to be honest about my symptoms, and I learned a lot. I learned, for example, that not everyone has suicidal thoughts. I thought everyone did. And it was a psychologist at the treatment program who told me, no, that's actually not true. And then during that year, I stepped down to intensive outpatient. That's like the next step after partial, at least in our US healthcare system. And, you know, I made friends. I was with other people. We were all going through the same thing. And that was the first time where I kind of focused on myself and not anyone's perception of, oh, like, what is this person doing? How's this person doing? I mean, I was off for a year and I earned $10.50 an hour after just having a full-time job as I was selling clothes. But I was really proud of myself because that's like, I have the motivation to be able to get up, submit my resume, which, I mean, literally at that point, to walk down the street was like, you just told me to run a marathon. It was so difficult. And, you know, I was proud of myself. I said, okay, this is me focusing on what I'm able to do. And it really did, like, it made me be honest that I was a lot sicker than I actually thought I was. And my body was like, I've been trying to tell you you're not okay, but I guess I had to kind of pull the brakes on your behalf. And that's pretty much what happened.
This is People First Radio. My guest is Alusha Ishagu. She's a behavioral health social worker and a doctoral candidate at Columbia University. She's sharing some of her experiences navigating a mental health issue during her master's degree. Was there any maybe particular moment, or what was the process like of maybe some of that acceptance you were just describing?
I would say I kind of felt like a hypocrite, to be honest. That's part of the acceptance process. I'm telling other people that mental illness is not a limitation and you should take care of yourself. Yet, whereas I'm willing to push myself into the ground. But I think part of the acceptance is mental illness is complex. It doesn't matter who you are, what type of diagnosis you are. There are going to be some hiccups in your everyday process. And I really struggled with the employment part because the way I had been raised, everything is school and job. Like coming from an immigrant household, it's what you can accomplish. Like everyone is, you're doing it not just for yourself. There are your parents who struggled it to come here. Then you have family in your home country. I'm Nigerian American who they would, you know, die to be in your shoes. Like, how dare you not leverage those opportunities? But I had to really recognize that, like, I think it's the four agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. He says that do your best, but your best is not always going to be the same thing. And I'm like, okay, right now for me, working at the store, selling clothes, folding things, cleaning the building, that's what I can do right now. And I'm doing it honorably, and I'm doing my best at my job. And I just felt no shame anymore because I could tell little by little that I was getting better as like my symptoms, my PTSD symptoms decreased. I was shocked. I said, okay, wow, that has never been the case. But I started to notice little differences. And even they made a huge medication adjustment at the hospital. And I'd secretly kind of been like, oh my God, am I going to become symptomatic? I'm going to end up there again. But I was fine because it's not just the meds. My environment was being addressed. So, yeah.
And then when you go back to grad school, it's a different grad school. And before, maybe the first time, you wrote about how you had some of these experiences with what I'll call bureaucracy, where it was like you were being asked for these documents and you couldn't get a good vibe on why. And I'm wondering if you could tell me, maybe contrast the two situations. Give me a bit more detail about what happened and how was it different at the other one?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's about February, and this is right before the pandemic. So February 2020, I reach out to the school because they told me I needed to essentially just get all this treatment. So I'm like, I've done everything you've told me to do. And I'm trying to, you know, register back into my program. I was getting a Master of Social Work and a Master of Public Health. So I was in a dual degree program. And I had kept in touch with the public health program the entire time I'd been off school. But I was told that I wouldn't even be allowed to be in the social work building at my university. Like I wasn't allowed to come into the school. And I was like, oh, wow, just... Thank you. I mean, I was actually speechless, but yeah. So I'm trying to get back in, and they keep asking me for all these documents, and I'm like, why do you need them? You're asking me for these treatment notes. You're asking me for my medications. Okay, even if you're asking me, can you let me know who will have access to these documents? Like, this is my information. And I think, again, it's a lot of people with mental disorders, our rights are very often violated, but you don't know any better. So you just go along with things and people do things to you that they're not allowed to. Perhaps this person could have been doing it the right way, but the fact that they refused to explain at least 5 times why they were asking and what they needed it for. And this was like during the pandemic. And at this point, I started feeling suicidal again. And I actually just felt, I was like, I actually feel like dying. And I told them, I'm like, to get to a point where you make a student feel like this again, knowing that this is essentially the feelings that were elicited when they left, something in my mind just clicked because I started to learn that I have more control than I think I do. I'm like, I don't have to take this. And I sent them an email stating that I was withdrawing from my programs. I let the social work program know, and I let the public health program know. And I wrote the dean of the social work school, and I told her, if you all don't address treatment for students with mental disorders, you're going to hemorrhage talent, because I was a token. You like me when nothing is wrong, but when I'm experiencing the reason why you were interested in me, then it becomes a problem. And I had gotten into Columbia University the first round, but I hadn't gotten into their MPH program. So I was kind of like, oh my gosh, okay, now I'm going to lose a program. I'm like, so be it. So I wrote them. I said, would I be able to come back to the university? And they let me know, you're going to have to reapply, obviously. So I reapply, get new recommenders, and then I'm accepted again. And it was like night and day. Like, I was honest about my symptoms, kind of my prior experience, because they have to see all your transcripts. So they see the other university's one, and they see the withdrawal on it, obviously. And they were just really, really supportive. I had so many opportunities, and I felt like I didn't feel ashamed for once that I had to pretend that I wasn't sick. I could be myself. And again, that doesn't mean you're broadcasting everything, but like not walking around with a sense of shame. Like, shame is a very heavy emotion. It's very tiring to walk around with that. So yeah, they were just so kind. I was shocked. I'm like, okay, I mean, this is going well. And I could tell my professors, like, they were like, we want you to succeed. And I felt really grateful. Yeah.
So it started with just the application process itself, but it carried through all the way through your experiences in your degree?
100%. There even was I became symptomatic again during the program. My second to last semester, I started having suicidal ideation, and I had to tell the professors, you know, very quickly, like, here's what's happening. And I'm like, my goal is to finish this program. I was supposed to graduate the next semester. And they really worked with me to get things done, to make sure that I had the appropriate support, that I was in contact with the right offices, because that's something I had learned. This is a disability. Use the resources around you. Stop trying to prove that you don't need help, because I'd seen so many other classmates who wouldn't say they needed any type of help until now you're failing a class. And it's kind of like, well, why didn't you say anything? And it's a hard thing. It's not that simple. It really isn't at all. But I was open with them, and, you know, they really supported me. And I wasn't sure if I was going to have to, you know, take a leave to go get treatment and come back. But the way the universe had it, the symptoms, it took some months for them to dissipate, but they went away. And my school supported me through that process as well.
How do you think of that idea now of navigating the way certain institutions or people can react to mental illness or a mental disorder versus the idea of like, oh, if I just plow through this and I'm, you know, still meeting whatever minimum threshold I needed to meet today to stay in this job or to stay in this course, ultimately knowing that if you don't seek some kind of help, you know, the consequences could be much greater in a few days or weeks. How do you approach that now, having been through all of these experiences?
It's still very difficult, because help is not, especially with mental illness, it's not like you quickly, you know, you go to a surgery and then you rest. This stuff takes time to really heal, because again, something can just trigger you in your environment and you can't explain why. And this is why, like, having, you know, just your kind of system with you, I start to know when I'm not feeling well, because my, you know, some of those negative thoughts start coming, and I have to remind myself, I have maladaptive suicidal ideation. So when I get overwhelmed, my mind starts having suicidal thoughts, because it's an escape. That's why they keep happening. That's my body's way of coping with being stressed. But I've just noticed the danger of not getting help means your life. Like, you could actually die. Like, it's no different than anything else. You're actually choosing to put yourself in danger. And society also encourages us to put ourselves in danger for the goal of making everything seem that it's okay. I believe in this concept of safe people. I have people at my current job who know what's going on. They don't know all the details, but they know enough to know if I wasn't doing well, they would be able to say, hey, you don't seem like you're fully all right. Or they're able to, you know, help with the process of me getting care and being able to take time off without it translating to me losing my job, for example. But I don't know, I'm a person of faith, and I've just noticed, I believe that everything happens for whatever reason, and that you really have to trust why things are happening. It doesn't make sense now, just like going into Columbia and losing a master's didn't make sense. But 2 years later, I get into a health education doctorate, which would be the equivalent, if not more, than the master's I wanted to do. So I trusted the process that, you know what, I don't get it. I'm just going to go along with this. And it didn't make sense until 2 years later. So choose your health. It's not, it's easier said than done, but choose your health. That's what I would say.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. My guest is Alusha Ishagu. She lives in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where she's a registered social worker. Today on the program, she's sharing some of her perspectives on mental health and mental illness. She's also told some of her story in a first-person piece you can read online on the website Mad in America. That piece is titled, Go Where You Are Watered. You also work with veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, and I'm wondering if, based on maybe your professional experiences, your personal experiences, you could share some of your thoughts. We were talking about in a prior conversation about diagnosis.
Yes. So at work, my portfolio covers veterans who have post-traumatic stress disorder, and then I also work with older veterans who have cognitive impairment and also have some type of mental disorder. So the thing about PTSD is PTSD can look like a lot of things. PTSD can make it look like you have bipolar disorder, or you have schizophrenia, or you have borderline personality disorder, because a lot of the times the names are given, but the different diagnoses share a lot of symptoms. So it can, one thing can look like the other, which is why psychiatry, it's a science, but it's also an art. So when I work with the veterans, you know, really getting to the root of, I'm not the one personally working with the diagnosing. I could be providing treatment for them in the sense of supportive counseling. So I'm kind of a bridge before you decide to do like an evidence-based practice, or I'm addressing your psychosocial circumstances and helping you notice patterns through different times. I have to maybe help you with the exact same thing. There's no issue helping with that resource, but are we seeing a greater trend that at this time of the year, you usually call me for X thing that we've already addressed prior? What could be going on? I'm a big believer in knowing what's happening to your brain, but also understanding that it's a conversation between you and your doctor. No doctor can just tell you, this is what you have, these are the medications, and you have no choice. You have a right to say no. It's called self-determination. I know it's confusing to people when some of us with mental disorders choose not to take our medication, but that's also self-determination, even if people don't agree with the way you've gone about treatment for yourself. Because at the end of the day, your doctor is not the one dealing with the side effects of the medications, some of which are, they're really serious, really, really serious.
On that front, is there anything you'd want more people to know about maybe antipsychotic medication in general?
Yeah. So one of the treatments for PTSD for some people, depending on the severity of their symptoms, could be an antipsychotic. When I personally got diagnosed first, I was on an antipsychotic alone. They had never addressed the depression. They just needed to knock out the current symptoms that were serious. I was hallucinating at that point. But these medications, they work. Like, all the hallucinations went away. And I also deal with intrusive images. So the images were gone as well. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. However, in the course of about a year, I gained 71 pounds. So these are the kind of things where you have to have a conversation with your patients. Some of us will start to have, you know, stiffness in our muscles. There's like a rigidity to your muscles. Some people develop, tardive dyskinesia, these movement disorders, or, you know, random things like your tongue coming out of your mouth and your tongue moving without you telling it to move, or kind of like chewing and it looks like almost like a horse is smacking. Those that was not my experience, but especially the higher your dose is, the more likely something like that will happen. And I was on a lower dose and I still had the significant weight gain and some of the muscle stiffness. So these medications do work, but with everything, you have to prep your patients with the fact that this could actually happen. And I want you to be aware of that. So there, the medications work. Some are better than others. And I have it such that should I ever get hospitalized, there are some of them that I'm like, I refuse to take this. Like, I don't want you to use this on me should I get hospitalized, just because of the some of the side effects that come with it. I mean, not to be TMI, at one point, my medication caused me to lactate. I've never had a baby in my entire life, but that's a side effect. How do you even explain that? Like, you know, there are ridiculous things like that. A company actually got sued because their medication caused men to develop breasts. Like, you imagine that's happening to someone's psyche. How do you even explain what's happening to your body? That's terrifying. So now you've added another stressor that the medication is supposed to help. The irony is, it's not lost on me at all, but they're very potent, very, very potent.
And I would imagine there's a value for people who maybe don't have anyone close in their life who's experienced something like that, to know about that, even just from the idea of stigma or judgment.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm a really big believer in, to whatever extent you feel comfortable, coming with as much information as you can find. I wasn't a health professional, but I'd been essentially trying to diagnose myself before I even got to the psychiatrist. I mean, I went through everything. I went through schizophrenia, anything in the schizophrenia family, anything in the bipolar family, and I got to depression. And I was like, I mean, yeah, this pretty much fits. I guess this is the closest to it. And then the PTSD symptoms, it was almost like check mark, check mark, check mark, check mark for almost all of the different symptoms. And it, at this point, essentially almost being chronic from when everything originally happened, ironically. So I believe in doing your research. I mean, when I started to have that experience with that antipsychotic that caused lactation, I immediately jumped online. And I also told the doctor, because here is the problem: when you're in your mind, oh, it's going to have side effects, you still have to let them know that it's having side effects. Because the moment I told her, she immediately pulled me off of it. Because for women, it can cause osteoporosis once that happens. So I was immediately taken off the medication and put on a different antipsychotic.
And your research now is all about, if I understand correctly, sharing information, maybe to improve mental health service uptake. Could you tell me more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. My current doctorate in health education, I'm doing it through Columbia's University Teachers College. It's the Department of Health Education and Applied Health Psychology. So my dissertation focuses on the attitudes of graduate students with psychiatric disabilities towards accommodation. When I was doing my research, I noticed that grad students with psychiatric disabilities, we were matriculating at similar rates, but we weren't completing at the same rate. So if accommodations that are still, at least for the US, a newer feature, pretty much it was, I think the ADA was 1990, Americans with Disabilities Act, that also helped with the advent of getting accommodations. If this is there, then why are we not completing at the same rate? And I know that it might not be the exact same, but there was such a drastic difference that I was like, huh, something is not making sense. And I'm like, there has to be something behind this, because part of service uptake, that's a service. That's part of the care that you, as someone who has a psychiatric disability, can get in higher education. So I'm really interested in understanding the lived experiences of those who have different mental disorders, and using that as the research base for creating these interventions. Like, those of us who are always being researched, let's be the researchers and let's tell people exactly why we are using accommodations or we're not using them, And part of what I postulate is that there is an element of stigma. People are terrified because, to an extent, there's a form of self-disclosure that happens between you and the professor. And I've noticed, and I've done it myself too, you give too much information because we're taught that an accommodation, subconsciously, a lot of us see it as an unfair advantage. And I'm like, you know what sounds unfair? Hallucinating. That sounds very unfair to me, or feeling like harming yourself. I'm like, that doesn't sound like a very fair thing. So if this is what helps everything balance out, but there are even professors who believe that in their own way, it's an unfair advantage almost. And if you can't handle the programs at that level, like, why would you be in the program in the first place? So I just want people to know they're not alone in this.
Could you tell me more about that idea of self-disclosure, and maybe especially from the perspective of, if you're the professor and someone is disclosing something to you, like, what would you hope that professor does? How would you hope they receive it?
I think, first of all, the professor understanding that a student even choosing to use an accommodation is a big deal. Like I said, in my graduate program, so many of us didn't use it, but then people would be having problems close to the end of the semester. And then a lot of the professors, I'm sure, are kind of like, why didn't you say anything? But there's a reason people aren't asking for it, and understanding the amount of courage the student would have had to muster up to even go to the Office of Disability Studies, know what to even ask for in the first place, because it's very confusing. It's not a straightforward process at all. Also, being able to tell you, this is what I'm going through, and you showing enough compassion so that the student doesn't have to feel like they have to give you every single nugget of what's going on with them, is bias is very real. People can say they don't have bias. All of us have bias. It's what you choose to do with the bias. And even those of us who work in the health education space, I mean, let's be honest, people are taught that people with mental disorders were scary, were crazy, were unstable. Like, we can't almost be trusted. Everything that comes out of our mouth has to be questioned. So just being a professor and noticing that, being honest with yourself that you also have bias. And I think there would be an arrogance to almost not acknowledge that, because that's ridiculous. All of us watch the same media, read the same news, you know, have similar conversations. So just noticing, it takes a lot of courage to even take that initial step.
Do you have conversations like these ones, maybe with the faculty in your program right now, and maybe some of your peers?
Yes. So we, for that kind of work, I did it more so from a, how can I put this? It was more of like an academic perspective. When I was in my previous program, I was one of the members of the Disability Justice Initiative. So we applied for a grant that would allow us to get funds in order to create what ended up being modules that would teach the university students for the School of Social Work about disability and disability culture. Because the whole idea is to sensitize and disseminate that information so it facilitates the process of students feeling like, okay, we are able to talk about this frequently. My professor has at least some knowledge base, and now I feel a little more comfortable talking to them. And, you know, similar to my program, the Teachers College, they are very well versed in understanding, you know, disability and accommodations. And this is going to be something shocking to people. I have never actually used an accommodation. And the reason I haven't is because when I first tried to get one, they gave me 10 pages of documents to give my psychiatrist. I don't have time for that. I know that sounds terrible. I'm like almost holding on for dear life because this is my second shot at this this master's program. I'm like, I have to keep moving. Like, this is like, it's slowing me down almost. So I just didn't give it to him. And at that point, I just kept going, and I took a huge gamble. I took a very, very huge gamble. Part of it was probably internalized stigma. Part of it was probably also like, truly, I'm like, this is taking too much time. Most of us see our psychiatrist once you're an established patient and you're stable for about 15 minutes. who can complete 10 pages of documentation in 15 minutes? Like, all of these barriers to you getting it, because it goes back to the idea that you have to prove that you need help. And that's part of working in an ableist structure. It's unfair that you should get this extra help. So let's make you prove that you need it. I'm like, I don't have time for this. So I kept it moving.
You're tuned in to People First Radio. Alusha Ishagu shared a story of two very different experiences of graduate school in a first-person piece published on the website Mad in America called Go Where You Are Watered. In the piece, she shared that it's been 5 years since she had the courage to take hold of her own destiny and to not let people make her feel like she was less than due to a diagnosis. Today on the program, Alusha Ishagu shares her story. Also on that idea of barriers, I'm just curious, anytime you were interacting with the medical system, for people listening in Canada, were you having to worry about like what your insurance covers, or if you did go to the hospital, like would you be able to afford it? Were those considerations you had to deal with?
So the way our healthcare structure in the U.S. works, most of us have employer-subsidized health insurance. I was able to pretty much see who I wanted to see, so long as they accepted insurance. Not everyone does. And I hate to say it, some of the psychiatrists that I would have wanted to work with, they didn't accept insurance, for example. So the last individual I worked with, every time I saw her, it was $220-something. So imagine when you're first becoming an established patient, the number of times they will see you, that's a lot of money. Most people don't have that. And I was working a full-time job and I was still having struggles paying for that. But in general, most people, if they take insurance, they will bill your insurance and then you have a copay. Unfortunately, sometimes with the way the mental health system works, there's a good chunk of people who don't accept insurance and they'll give you a sliding scale, but a sliding scale where the minimum is $75. I'm like, $75 that's not a small amount of money. I'm like, that's a nice chunk of money. And I saw it even more so once I was out of school that semester or that year I took off. My university very generously allowed me to have the insurance for a year, but I forgot when the insurance cut off. I want to say like at the end of the school year, it cut off. So I was using Medicaid, and Medicaid only pays for specific people. It's not that you can go to every single person, because some people, again, they don't accept insurance. And the doctor I'd been working with at that time, I'm trying to remember, did they accept insurance? But the therapist did not accept Medicaid. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. So now you're trying to develop a relationship with someone and might get to a point where you can't pay. And people, you know, the providers feel bad, the clinicians, because they want to help you, but they also have to earn an income through the work that they do. So my medication, for example, the time I was uninsured, which was the summer before I went to grad school, I was getting free samples from a nurse that I knew. So I was getting sample antipsychotics, because if I had paid out of pocket, the medication for a 30-day supply was $1,200. I do not have $1,200. So, yeah, it's a lot of money.
That sounds like a lot to navigate through. The idea of having to get free samples from a nurse for antipsychotic medication.
Yeah, it was tough. And I feel like I've just had these, like, you know, helpers along the way who really, you know, supported me and gave me things like this. But what if you weren't the person who had a nurse who could give you the antipsychotics, because the new one they had put me on wasn't in a generic version at that time. And even those that are generics, they're still expensive if you're uninsured, but that one wasn't generic. And it was, yeah, about $1,200 for a 30-day supply. And I know the danger of what it means to suddenly come off of a medication. Why I ended up having my first ever hospitalization is I was working with a doctor back in the DC metro area, which is where I grew up. and I wasn't able to get my new prescription yet for the new medications. And I told her that this thing doesn't seem like it's working. I was on Raylar, which is a second generation antipsychotic. And after 2 days of not taking it, I started having suicidal thoughts. So it really is dangerous. Like, you can't just suddenly stop taking it, but some people don't have a choice. So yeah, it's expensive, very expensive.
How would you say everything is going now?
For the most part, 8.5 out of 10. 8.5 stars out of 10. That's how life is going. As sometimes, you know, it can be really, really tough. I've learned to celebrate all types of wins, as it's things you take for granted. Like, my living room is clean. That's a win for me, because a lot of us who have depression, your house looks like a tornado came through, and it's just frequently messy. And actually, a family member was telling me that's how I could kind of tell you weren't fully okay, because your room was always so messy. And growing up, you were never an untidy person. So, you know, just the irony of stuff like that, like, you know, I can cook again. I don't always want to do it, but that's something that I lost the desire to do when I, you know, started becoming really symptomatic. I had no desire to cook, so I wasn't eating. And unfortunately, I discovered Uber Eats. So that should be a case study in itself. The amount of money people with psychiatric disabilities spend on Uber Eats, I'm sure people would be, they would be shocked. Because you, for some of us, you just have no desire to do anything. And when I say anything, obviously that's a part of depression, but cooking in that instance. So most of the time, things are fine. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes it's really, really tough. I still struggle watching really sad things, because it takes me to not the best of spaces. So this is, what, 4 or 5 years later, and I'm still being careful. Like, there's the Netflix movie From Scratch. I don't know if you're familiar with it. That movie, it has like Zoe Saldana and this other person. It's based on a real life story. And I watched it and I started having SI, like, what's the point of life? So I was like, oh, wow, I pulled the plug immediately. I was like, I'm not watching the rest of the show, because it had several episodes. So you're never fully healed. But I'm honest with myself when I do need help. I haven't had intrusive images since like 2016, when I started taking an antipsychotic. And then my brother got married in March, and they came back with a force I don't even remember. So when I think of the fact that I went X number of years, because it had been happening before 2016, having those kind of horrible images, and mine are usually, like, I have contamination OCD, and I'm stating a number of disorders so people hear many things, but also remembering that disorders share symptoms. So we can call it social anxiety, depression, all of those things, but they have a lot of overlap in symptomology. But I would usually just see dirty, just gross things. And I'm like, this is hell on earth. Like, who can live like this? And I kind of panicked. Am I going to have to go on the antipsychotic again? The psychiatrist says, do you want to get a higher dose of your current medication? So currently I use a mood stabilizer and antidepressant. And then there's a medication I use for nightmares. I don't have nightmares, but it helps with PTSD flashbacks as well. So it's been helping with flashbacks of my, like, some of the experiences. But I was like, am I going to have to use this medication again, this blasted antipsychotic? But he was like, well, part of it too is acknowledging that this is coming because you're stressed out. So everything is not necessarily always a medication adjustment. But sometimes, if it is, going along with that process. School is going well, not always perfect, but I'm trying my best. I like my classmates a lot. I like my courses, and just getting to really pursue my dream of, now I'm the researcher and not just the research. But yeah, 8.5 stars out of 10. That's what I give it.
I remember in your writing on some of your experiences, you used the phrase, my mental health struggles have not dissipated. However, I can actually say that I am well.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not like you're not going to be magically cured or healed. unfortunately, that really, for some people, they'll never become episodic again. I know for myself, the medications helped me, and not just the medications. I addressed my environment. I remember I saw a quote, sorry, I live for a good quote, and it said, it's not always about an external relocation. Sometimes it's an internal renovation. And my inside was, I was a mess. You know, I'd lived in this place and that place, and I'm going to grad school in a new state. But it's like, but you're still struggling. You're the common denominator. So like, what's wrong? Like, what could be causing all of this disconnect and struggle? And I genuinely do feel, while I wake up a lot more grateful than most people probably would, is like, I used to have a fear of being homeless. Every day I wake up in my bed, I'm just like, wow, four walls around me, my bills are paid, there's food to eat. Even if there wasn't food, you have running water. So the water, at least you can drink water for the time being. Like, I have shelter. And these are things, when you have a serious mental illness, like, people do become homeless. I met someone with my diagnosis, he was homeless. That's terrifying to see yourself, like, you're in the process of getting sick and you're like, wow, well, that could be me. So I'm very grateful for what I have. Doesn't mean to everything is perfect, and it's okay to speak up when things aren't. That also doesn't make you an ingrate if you say something.
You're listening to People First Radio. We've been hearing from Alusha Ishagu. She's a social worker in Philadelphia and a doctoral candidate in Columbia University's education program. She's been sharing some of her experiences, personal and professional, particularly a tale of two very different experiences of grad school back when she was getting her master's. If you're just tuning in and want to learn more about her story, you can check out her first-person piece on the website Mad in America. It's titled, Go Where You Are Watered. Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to a conversation like the one we're having today?
There is no one way to approach mental health or mental disorders. I'll always notice that people want to police how people discuss certain things, but understanding that you're speaking from your experience. My experience also is informed by science, but it's still human beings creating the science behind the conversations that we're having. And I would just tell people, lean on those who also have lived experience, but also realize that people are speaking from their vantage point and their experience, and stop using TikTok as a diagnosis mechanism. Don't use it. It's not safe. Everyone now has convinced themselves they have X, Y, and Z and A, B, and C, and listen to the experiences of those with lived experience. We're going through this every single day. What you're learning about in a book, I'm living 24 hours a day. So keeping that in mind.
Two things there I wanted to follow up on. Both the idea of maybe like policing language around mental health and using TikTok and maybe self-diagnosing with things. Are there any in either of those, any big trends or big things you think are important to highlight?
Yes. So people think mental health, that's the illness. Everyone has mental health. You can have good mental health or poor mental health. The issues people have, and every time you have a mental health struggle as well, that doesn't mean that you have a mental illness. Those are not always the same thing. Sometimes you can experience anxiety as an episode or depression as an episode. Now, when you're dealing with it from a more longer term experience, that's when it could become an actual diagnosis. But there are different forms of these things. So understanding that all of us are still learning. There's language we used before that we no longer use now. There's a reason why. Like, it's not a magic process, but, you know, people speaking kindly when you're discussing mental illness. I'm a really big believer in not describing someone as a diagnosis. You're not bipolar or schizophrenic. That's just my belief. People don't have to agree with me. It's just, that's part of what you have. And in those instances, people always try to say, oh, but in this other instance, we would say the same thing. This person is this, but it's not always apples to apples. It's the it's what is a result of you saying that. Somebody saying that what's a good example? There's no example that comes to mind.
Is
right
it
now,
that idea of like a person-centered language, like someone with bipolar or someone with schizophrenia?
100%. And let people describe themselves to you. Some people will say, I'm bipolar. That is their right. That doesn't mean that you should now come and then go to someone who else has bipolar and said, oh, you're bipolar, right? No, let them tell you how they want you to discuss their disorder, but really being careful with policing language, but also people being willing to be corrected with kindness. I would hope that that's not language that is empowering to someone. And for the TikTok trend, because now there's so much, and it's not just TikTok, social media writ large, a lot of us got our doctorate degrees from Google University. Google is a wonderful tool. I'm not saying it's not, because that's where I started, but I presented a trained professional with ideas based off of what I saw so that we could have a conversation. But mental health is something that people are more willing to talk about. But because to an extent, and it's ironic, the way that it can be treated as a pseudoscientist, sometimes when people even make jokes that psychiatrists aren't real doctors, which doesn't make sense because they go to med school like everyone else. So why would you even say that? There's a reason behind it. So now everyone is a psychiatrist, psychologist, social worker, and they grasp onto some type of information they found. And now they're telling the masses this. And misinformation is a really dangerous thing. It's a really serious threat to public health. So no one is saying that you can't learn and glean from online sources, but also you need to check people's credentials out. I myself, I'm someone with lived experience. My diagnosis caused me to essentially use almost every type of psychiatric medication, antidepressant, anti-anxiety, antipsychotic, mood stabilizer, like medications for PTSD. I've tried the gamut. So I can talk about a lot of medications, but still, I did not go to med school. Some medications have certain implications. There's a reason why your primary care doctor in the US can't write an antipsychotic and your psychiatrist has to. Again, there's a reason behind it. So talk to friends, get involved with forums, but most of us live in echo chambers and you pick up falsehoods. And now I've had people tell me more about mental disorders than I know because they did some research. And my mind is just kind of like, okay, what do you even say to that? I mean, I've had literally people challenge the knowledge that I have, because again, if mental illness is treated like a pseudoscience, oh, I just read about this and I feel like I'm informed now. There's actually a lot of the hubris behind that is you can't know more than what someone themselves is experiencing. That doesn't really make sense. And yeah, it's ridiculous, but people, they're interested in learning. So I guess that's a bright side. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being willing to share some of your experiences with us.
Yeah, thank you all so much. This is a really great program. If you want to learn more about my work, I wrote an article in Madden America called Go Where You're Watered, and it pretty much reflects what we talked about today about my experience with mental disorders. I'm an advocate. I'm here for you if you need me. But also, I would encourage people to seek help wherever help is found. Professionals are great, as our friends are not always equipped to deal with the seriousness of what we're going through. So to keep that in mind as well.
Alusha Ishagu lives in Philadelphia, where she's a social worker helping veterans at the city's VA Medical Center. She's also a doctoral candidate in Columbia University's Teachers College Health Education Program.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Some people may be tempted to attribute visible homelessness to things like mental illness and addiction. But nurse Abe Outsorn says there's another cause driving homelessness in Canada's richest cities. Success.
When we look at the data, you get some really strange phenomena where perhaps more poor cities, cities with a lower income across the board, may have less homelessness than rich cities like the Torontos and the Vancouvers and the Calgarys of the world. And then with things like mental illness, when you look even globally, the rates of mental illness tend to be pretty much the same across sort of high income nations, around kind of a 20 to 22% lifetime expectancy. Yet the rates of homelessness in these countries differ drastically. And so it's actually not the mental illness that's causing the homelessness. What's happening is things like mental illness, poverty, addiction are discriminating for who will be homeless. But what's causing homelessness is that housing is expensive, rare, and in high demand. And what happens then is cities that are successful, so cities that are wealthy, that are growing, that tend to have high employment, end up being the cities with the highest rates of homelessness because their housing prices are so high.
Abe Outsorn speaking about success as a driver of homelessness. You can hear the full conversation on next week's program. That is all for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A reminder, you can find the show as a podcast. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, on Instagram, and on Facebook. Just search People First Radio on any of those platforms. Thank you very much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.